Okay, good morning, everyone. Baruch Shechianu, Vikimanu, Vigyanu, Lazman Azeh. Welcome to a new Zman. And it's really exciting to be back and be learning Machshava with you. Today, as you know, we have a special guest. But just before we got there, I wanted to give everyone a shkayach on your bechinas, which were overall, I think everyone did very well. Hopefully you felt the same way. A number of you mentioned to me that Zoom is hard. It's hard to stay focused, and I agree. And also, I think a downside of Zoom is that at least for many of you, I don't get to know you because I don't see you in person. So that's why I thought that we should have a in-person option as well. A number of people said that in person isn't going to work for as well for them. And to be honest, this year that it's in Zoom overall, there are fewer people that miss. So I sent out a survey. And again, if you didn't fill in the survey yet, please do, to work out a option for in person. And assuming that we could work something out, it'll be your choice. You could either come on Zoom or in person, but in person will hopefully give us a chance to also have more of a feeling of a chevra and more of give me a better chance to get to know you guys and the like. So please fill out that survey as soon as you can so we could start next week with that. Okay, today's shiur is going to be a little different than what we usually do. Usually we try to learn a sugya in machshava, to learn a be'ion, to see different makoros, to spend time thinking about what the sources are really saying, to ask questions, to ponder, and the like. The goal isn't to be able to answer questions, dama lahashav lapikores, or lavdafka pikores, but someone who's questioning, it's to learn the sugyas. Through that, hopefully, we'll be able to answer people's questions. But that's not the direct goal. And I thought that it would be worthwhile, at least for one shiur, to work on the question of the skill, to develop the skill of being able to answer people's questions. And there are lots of questions, but to specifically focus on some of the most difficult challenges that we are asked as mechanchim, as rabbanim, as just Orthodox Jews. The Mishnah in Pirkei Avos says that dama al-hashiv l'apikoros is something that's very important. And I think, again, apikoros here isn't really even the issue necessarily. All sorts of people have questions. And I could think of no better person to do this with or to actually teach us about this than Rav Chaim Jachter. Rabbi Jachter is a huge Talmud Chacham, as many of you know, and he's someone who I think, I've known him for many years, and he was, I certainly knew of him before I got to know him, and I knew him as a posek, as a Talmud Chacham, as a dayan. I recently had a question about how to spell a certain name in a ksuba, and I came across a document that he wrote where he spelled the names of all different places, a very helpful tool for those of you interested. And he wrote tremendous svarim, gray matter, recently a pamphlet on Hakafas Harosh, on all sorts of very important questions. And he's in Torah of standard halacha, gemara, a huge, huge Talmud Chacham. A number of years ago, though, he put out a book. In the document that I attached for you, I put, the book is called Reason to Believe, Rational Explanations of Orthodox Jewish Faith. And there's also a link to where you could buy it, though I'm sure you could also buy it in local farm stores, and I'm sure it'll be at the soy farm sale coming up soon. And it's a very different type of sefer than he usually writes. It's not on halacha. It's on rational explanations for Orthodox Jewish faith. And it addresses some of the most basic questions in a very clear and straightforward way. And maybe he'll tell us a little bit more about how he decided to write this book. But the basic answer is because there was a need. There was a tzorech. And someone like Rabbi Jachter, who, when there's a need for something, he got up and he did it. And it's a tremendous resource. And that's what we're going to be talking about today, the types of questions that I'm sure you've already been asked, and you're certainly continue to be asked. And that's funny, in the back and forth when I was talking to him about how to do this this class. So I asked him for a list of questions that he thinks that we should address. And he sent me some, and then he sent me more. And I was like, whoa, how are we going to get through all those things? And he says, no, you have to give short answers. It's like, short answers? I don't like short answers. But he's right that sometimes somebody asks you a question, and if you start giving them a shear and giving them a koros and talking and the like, they will lose interest well before you get to your answer. And there's a value as well. There's a value certainly in knowing the sugya and learning it beyond and the like, but there's also a tremendous value in being able to give a quick answer, an elevator pitch or whatever it's called. And that's, again, what we're going to be doing today. So what I think we're going to do, I'm going to let Rabbi Jachter share any general insights, but then we're going to get right into it. And the list of the questions that I'm going to ask, I already shared with you. It's in the document that is in the link in the chat. There's also another resource I want to suggest that you consider using. And I put a link to that as well in the, you know what, I'll just put it in the chat again. But it's, did that not work? Didn't work. Well, I'll figure out how to do that in a second. But it's from, it's a series of shiurim that were given by Rav Aaron Lapiansky, my Rebbe, entitled Dama Lahashiv. And these shiurim are really excellent. Now, they're not short answers. Here, I put up the link in just now. They're not short answers either, but it's an incredible opportunity also to hear a tremendous Talmud Chacham talk about these types of questions, why we believe, questions of the Masorah, dealing with issues of science and evolution and all sorts of things. And I would certainly suggest listening to these series of shiurim, which are also very helpful, different than his usual shiurim, but also very helpful for this type of thing. So I want to turn it over to Rabbi Jachter, and then we'll begin.
Hey, thank you, Rabbi Wiederblank, for the overly generous introduction. But I wanted to emphasize right at the outset, I know that it's very hard to maintain focus and attention on Zoom. But what we're doing today, and I want to emphasize right at the outset, what we're dealing today is Dvarim Ha'omdim Berumo Shel Olam, incredibly important points. And we're dealing with Kvod Shamayim. Literally, Kvod Shamayim. People look to us for Rabbanim, or even if you're not going to be practicing Rabbanim, they're going to be looking to us to give answers. And if you don't have an answer, it's not just you look bad. You know, they're not going to say Jachter is dumb. They're going to say you'll forgive me. They're going to say the Torah is dumb, God forbid. You know what I'm saying? This is what people are going to think. They're going to think about us. So therefore, I'm going to ask everyone to try to, despite all the difficulties, and I know how difficult it is, I'm going to ask everybody right from the outset to try to focus as best you can and try to take it as seriously as you can, because literally, if we, and I know this from experience, I remember what it was sitting on these Friday classes also when I was your age, you know, 30 million years ago. But I remember it vividly. But hopefully today it's a start in giving you some tools to know how to answer questions. And again, I want to emphasize, not just for guys who are actually going to be in the field, but even if you're not going to be, maybe even more important for the people not in the field. You know, you're going to be in an office and you're going to be a lawyer or something. And you're the only, you know, this is the Orthodox Jew, and he's even has smicha. Maybe they even know that he's an ordained rabbi. And they're going to expect you to come up with answers. And you have to do, you have to know the answer. Because God forbid, you make a big chil Hashem. We all, God forbid, we make a big chil Hashem if we don't have the answers. So I beg you, please, everyone, try to, you know, be involved. And try as best you can to try to take whatever you can out of the shiur. Now, before I start delving into the issues and sort of going to give Rabbi Wiederblank the chance to answer me some questions, I'm going to say something I'm not going to do in this shiur. I'm not going to do something that I know is a turnoff to people who did not go to TABC. I'm so excited to see there's a whole bunch of people here that I'm so excited to see. That I'm jumping out of my skin to out of excitement, to say hello to them. But the problem with my doing that is that the guys who are not my Talmidim were the ones I don't know. You know, Simcha, you know, my son's old friend Eli Fink is a good friend. You know, all these I can't do that because the problem is that everybody else, everybody else is going to feel excluded. So Aviel, you hear what I'm saying? Don't be upset that I'm not going, oh, it's Aviel. Okay, don't be upset. I feel like doing that, but I'm really being kovish my Yetzirah tremendously. I'm Zach Rothenberg is here. Whoa. Okay, sorry. I'm being kovish. I just got through a speech that I'm going to control myself and not do that. And all the TABC guys who are here, I know I'm, Eitan Schnarr and Yoni Lab, who saved my life one time. Hopefully we'll get to that. Zev Jarrah show, to say the least. A whole bunch of stories that I have to get to over here hopefully we'll get to that by the time that we're done. We're done, Rabbi Wiederblank. How long do we have? We have till 11:30?
11:30. People might start leaving at 11:30, but if we're in a, you don't have to stop in the middle of a sentence.
All right. So let's see if we can do it quickly. I'm going to change the order of the questions that I gave you. Let's start with one, if you don't mind. I'm going to tell you how to ask the question.
Okay.
Let's
no
start
problem.
With question number one. Go ahead.
Okay. And just I want to make one. I don't think I'm disagreeing with what you said, but I guess just Tahara, which is you said that if we say we don't know, that too is a chilul shem shemayim. But I would say that saying I don't know is still a lot better than giving the wrong answer.
That's true.
And sometimes we have to also be willing to say I don't know.
You better get back to an answer within a couple of hours.
Right, and get back with an answer. As opposed to trying to wing it and saying the wrong thing. All right.
But if you don't know certain basic things, it's really, really bad. All right. Now, so also one other introduction, and we'll start getting into it because we don't have too much time. Okay. So you may ask, if we're going to give our regal achas answers, what's the value in giving our regal achas answers? So what's the response to that? Do we have any source in the Gemara about that to give 1 second answers, to give elevator speeches? What's the makor for elevator speeches? Yeah, who wants to say?
The Gemara Shabbos with Hillel.
Of course, right now. Of course, now I remember one time I was giving this talk and some to a veteran, rabbanim, and one of the people said, "It's terrible. How can you give answers in 1 second?" So I said to him, "You're exactly like the shita, like who? That's exactly who?
Shammai.
That's Shammai. Okay, they're right. They're right also." But we need but there's a place for Hillel also. We have to know how to give quick answers. All right, let's see if we can give some regalachas answers to these questions. Okay, Yes, Rabbi Wiederblank. Yes.
There are thousands of religions in the world. Why should I believe in Judaism more than any other?
Okay, so who wants to give the 5-second? If you don't know that, it's really, really bad. Who can give me the 5-second answer to that one? Who can give me the 5-second answer? Just yell it out. Yeah.
Mass revelation.
Mass revelation. Thank you. Two words. There we go. Maybe we could add on two. Maybe we could add on two things to the mass revelation argument. Just to you. How many? You have to know that. That's very odd. Okay. But more than that, I want to add one thing. Well, you'll say, well, maybe we were fooled. What's the best proof that we weren't fooled? Because we're a difficult people. You know what I'm saying? And what's the best proof that we're a difficult people? We are here. Sometimes you need on a bag of potato chips, you need five hashgachos. But more than that is that the Chumash describes us as difficult people, as argumentative people, and we're that way today. What other people in the universe have this as their second holiest book as the Gemara? How do you describe the Gemara to someone who doesn't know anything about Gemara? Al regalachas, give a 5-second answer to what the Torah is. What is the Gemara? Al regalachas. It's 2,700 pages of what? Of arguments. What other people in the world have a 2,700 page book of every single page full of arguments? That's who we are. That's our nature. That's who we are. So this kind of a people that are argumentative and smart, right? Look at the Nobels. 25% are around, approximately 25% are from Jews. Smart, argumentative, contentious people. And we're the ones to say that we experienced a mass revelation. We weren't fooled. People like that are not fooled. Next. Torah also very quickly. The Torah predicts it. Look in Perek Vav, Hashama'am, Kol Medaber Elokim Yitochei Shayechi. Is there a people, the Torah predicts, that there will never be a people who will even make the claim of a mass revelation. No one even makes that claim. So that's something very, very huge. Yes, so that's our Regalachas answers here. That's next, Rabbi Wiederblank. Okay, keep shooting. Actually, let me give you the next one, which I want to do. Let's go to three. Three should be the next one. Go ahead.
Okay, why should I believe what this book says about the 10 plagues, the Sinaitic revelation, splitting the sea, etc.?
Okay, so who wants to give, why should I believe the book? Who wants to give a decent answer to that one?
Why isn't it the same as the previous question?
5-second answer. Yeah, Brian, yeah?
Why isn't it the same as the previous question? I mean, this is the same answer. This is the revelation. This is the tradition.
Why should I believe there was a revelation? That's really the question. In other words, the book is, do we believe, and this is very important. It's unbelievable how, I don't think I realized this till I was in my mid-40s, but it's very important. It's hugely important. Do we believe it just because the book, because the Torah says so, because the book says it? Just because the book can say anything. Someone wrote in a book and they passed it down. Why should we? Oh, because you'll say, because why? Because there's a companion volume to the Torah. What's the companion volume to the Torah? Who are the companion volume to the Torah?
Levin.
What? I'm sorry?
Levin.
Yeah, no. They're around today. They're around today. They are the biological descendants of the people who this book describes. Who experienced this mass revelation? Where can you find the biological descendants of the people who experienced this mass revelation?
Local synagogue?
Yeah, you can find them right here. I mean, that's us. You know what I'm saying? We're the companion volume of the Torah. That's number one. Let's see if we can get it out quickly. Number two, look, the Torah makes predictions, and Torah brings these predictions. Never should have happened. They happened. You know, this is the have you seen the seven wonders of Jewish history, the Eish HaTorah presentation? So that you should, if you haven't seen it, you should see it. The Torah makes these contradictory predictions. The Jewish people are going to go into exile and going to come back. That doesn't happen. When a nation goes into exile and they're exiled all over the world, typically what happens is that they assimilate, because normal human sociology is that the few want to be like the majority, and give it a couple of generations, they just blend into the majority, right? You know what I'm saying? And the Torah makes a prediction that we're going to return after this exile, and it happened. So we see this here. Torah predicts that we're going to be a tiny nation, ma'at mikol ha'amim, and minivrachu v'kol kamish v'kol sa'adamah v'zarachah. I'm going to bring great bracha to the whole world. Has that happened? Yeah. You want to give a 5-second example of this. A 5-second example is Israel brings water. Israel brings water to more than 100 nations of the world, including the most poor and desperate. You know what I'm saying? Contradictory predictions. The Torah predicts the Torah will never be forgotten. Here we're coming up on Purim, Rosh Chodesh Adar, coming around Chodesh Adar Aleph. Right? Torah predicts Lo tishachach mi pi zaro. The Torah will never be forgotten. In Purim it says that v'zichron lo yasuv mi zaron. In a book, here let's talk about the Megillah for a second. In a book that describes how the Jews narrowly avoided a genocide, the book basically says v'zichron l'yasuf mizaran, that the Jewish people will always be observing Purim. It's saying the Jewish people are always going to be around, and it's crazy, and it's happened. To me, this is what works. These are things that work for me. But if it's, you know, but you have to say to people also, if they don't find your answer convincing, say, this works for me. If it doesn't work for you, ask others. But that's always a good caveat to add. Rabbi Weirblank, let's see if we can go to 1C. Evidence of Hashem's continued intervention in the world. Can we get a 1-second answer? Can we give our regalachas answer to evidence of Hashem's continued intervention in the world? Anyone want to give that one a shot?
You know, the state of Israel.
Yeah, and good. That's right.
In other words,
Yoni, what?
Survival of the Jewish people.
Survival of the Jewish people. And it's really the two answers are one and the same. Yoni's answer and the other young man, I'm sorry, who gave that answer.
Zachary.
Zachary. Zachary and Yoni's answer were really identical. In other words, I like to call Israel the ongoing Hanukkah miracle, because literally it's 74 years of Rabin Biad Ma'atim, of hundreds of millions of people that are very much opposed to our existence and want anything more than anything else to destroy us, and we survive. But that's just Medinat Yisrael's survival is just reflects. The miracle of Israel's survival reflects the miracle of the Jewish people's survival. The very fact that we are here today, learning Torah today, is a miracle. It never should have happened on so many levels, In the 1950s, there were maybe a couple of hundred yeshiva students in the whole world. And look what it is, look what it is today. People thought orthodoxy in the 1950s was gone. Why did Ben-Gurion grant a exemption to yeshiva students from serving the army? He thought they weren't going to continue to exist. This is what was the accepted thought process in the 40s and the 50s. But look what we hear from, not just from the Holocaust. Yeah. Okay. Let's go now to D. Let's go. I'm sorry. To four. Four, please, Rabbi Weiderblank. Go ahead.
Why should I believe in the authority of the Talmud?
Okay, so I remember saw a video on Reform talking about Reform Judaism, where it started. I remember they're saying it was a pretty nasty video, pretty nasty anti-Orthodox. Every once in a while, I think it's a good idea to take a look at it. You have to see what other people are saying to know how to respond. So how do you respond to that? So I like to give these examples in the Gemara. Which crazy cases in the Gemara and how they become alive today. Can anybody give me some examples? I'll give you a shot. I'm going to give you an example of the Gemara.
I mean, there's a famous one about Siamese twins.
Okay, right. The Gemara Menachos. Good one. Becomes right for that. That was the source for Moshe, or part of the source for Moshe's famous ruling about Siamese twins. Good. What's the, okay, here. Let me tell you the Gemara in Sanhedrin, Ayin Zayin Amud Beis. You should know this Gemara, Bidka Demaya, and classic Gemara, and tell me what's a modern day application. You do this hundreds of times a day, today. Here's the Gemara. Somebody ties up somebody, and he puts them near a dam of water, and you unleash the dam and the water comes whooshing out and kills him. If it's direct, it's chayiv misa. If it's indirect, he's putter from chayiv misa's based in. Right? That's a case of bidga demayas. So what's the relevance today? Where do we have that today? Anybody know? Think of it for 5 seconds. Where do you really unleash a dam and you release a whoosh? Yeah? That's when you complete an electric circuit. Think about that. Yeah, and if it's grama, if it's indirectly and the results only later, that's how you can open up a refrigerator on Shabbos, according to Rosh Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. Right? The air comes, you open up the door, that's the barrier, and the air whooshes in, and it's a delayed reaction in causing the motor of the air conditioner to go on. You hear what I'm saying? Yeah, the Gemara speaks about, talk about shaving. The Gemara speaks about shaving with Gemara at the end of Makos, about shaving with a scissor. Shaving with a scissor, crazy cases. What do you see? But today, that's yom yom. That's the electric shaver. So you hear what I'm saying? These crazy cases in the Gemara. And yet it's the relevance is all any new issue that comes up, there's a precedent in the Gemara. Any new issue comes up with the press in the Gemara. Unbelievable. It's shining. And give hundreds, you can give hundreds of examples of this. That's, to my mind, unbelievable that it's min hashamayim. Yes, Rabbi Wiederblank. Let's see if we go to number five. Go ahead.
Why should I believe Orthodox Judaism over Conservative or Reform Judaism?
Okay, so if you can make me a co-host, I want to just show you an article in the share screen for 2 seconds.
Okay.
If you can't, I'll just tell.
No, I should be able to do that. 1 second. Here we are. Okay. You should be able to.
Okay, hold on. Let me get this up. Okay, here we go. All right, there we go. All right, does everybody see the article that we have here? This is from the Jewish Telegraphic Agency, not Orthodox. Here, op-ed written by someone who is not Orthodox. He says straight out, I'm not Orthodox. Judaism is more than Tikkun Olam. Look what he says over here. He says here, we should know by now that the non-Orthodox way of life is failing by just every metric we have at our disposal. Hear what I'm saying? You know, this question about how do I know conservative or reform, that would be a question when I was growing up. In the 1970s, when 50% of American Jewry are conservative, hey, what about conservative halacha? But they're a complete failure. And I was shocked to see that article, pleasantly surprised to see that article, as someone who's acknowledging the truth and saying, you know, we want to survive as Jews, we have to become Orthodox. It's a shocking article. But it gets across the point. They're an absolute failure. In the 2020 Pew study, conservative Judaism for underage 30, 7% of Jews. It's gone in my lifetime. It's gone from over 50% to 7%. It's a complete failure. The same with reform and reconstruction. It's a complete failure. The only way to go is with us. Let's go now to the orthodoxy is the only way that lasts. This is an example of what Williams James called the pragmatic theory of truth. That sometimes what works is true. And only orthodoxy works. Conservative reform are a complete failure. Can we go to number 12, Rabbi Wiederblank?
The halacha is impossible to sustain, and even those who claim to live in accordance with halacha don't really do so.
Okay, so I've seen this in anti-Orthodox movies. Unfortunately, you have quite a few of them, I can think of one of those movies. One of the movies comes to mind, but I think really the best answer, and the best answer to that is as follows, and it's a huge point. You see, every single one of us, every single Orthodox Jew, I was told the Rosh Hashiva from Ner Yisroel of Weinberg made this point, that Orthodox Jews today have the status of what the Gemara speaks about an Adam Chashuv. When an Adam Chashuv sins, it's a tremendous Chil Hashem. It's a tremendous Chil Hashem, because if the Adam Chashuv is going to sin, that means he doesn't take it seriously. So certainly for Rabbanim, the Gemara in Shabbos says, if we Rabbanim sin, it's not just like anybody else sins. So if you're doing it publicly, we have to be, you know, you're getting the smich, your first year smich. I wish somebody told me this when I'm on a Friday shir. If you're going to be a rabbi of a shul, or you're going to be in the shul and you're known as a Ben Torah, and you are going to talk during davening, Not only is it an avera, you're also making a tremendous chil Hashem. You see, people, they don't take the Torah seriously. I remember as a kid, I feel bad in saying this, but I remember seeing people who should not have been, well, not just any Jews, but especially people who presented themselves as Torah role models as speaking Lashon Hara. But I remember, On the other hand, that I remember as a boy encountering in high school, encountering Rav Yitzchak Cohen in the Mar Shakol. I remember seeing that. I remember seeing him and the way he behaves. I said, this is a tremendous Kiddush Hashem, because he really said, this is someone that really, really keeps the Torah. And I really felt that just seeing him and interacting with him was a tremendous uplift. And the answer is that all of us have the capability. You know, it's hard to be as a holy Jew as he is, but all of us to be consistently keeping, observing the Torah. And the way to try to give chizik to ourselves is realizing that if you're going to fail, it sets a terrible example, and you are communicating that even the rabbis don't take it seriously. So if even the rabbis don't take it seriously, it's not serious. It's not min hashamayim. So at the very least, we have to take it seriously. And any observant Jew, are communicating something terrible if they're not observing. But kol shekein for us. I know it's a hard pill to swallow, but it's a very important pill to swallow. Okay, let's go now to six.
Can we after?
Yes.
I wasn't sure how that answered the question. The question is the title that other people have against Orthodox Jews. Is that correct?
Yeah. So I think the answer is when you see people who like a Rav Yitzchak Cohen, if you see them that they're so careful observing the Torah, say, whoa, this person really keeps the Torah. I remember as a 15-year-old boy when I encountered Rav Yitzchak Cohen for the first time, that's what I said to myself. This man really keeps the whole Torah, and that was a tremendous chizuk to me, because I was very bothered by that. I said, why are these other people? They seem that they're cutting corners on different things, and this man doesn't cut corners. And hopefully all Orthodox Jews should be like that. But when you at least the Rabbanim setting a good example, then we make that's the best response to this Tana, and people say that. All right, let's go to a fun one. Actually, let's go to Yehonatan. I hope I gave a decent answer. Let's go to number 11. You are stuck in the past. Go ahead. Yeah, Rabbi Wiederblein.
I think you just said it.
This is a good story. This is a story of you're stuck in the past. That you I was walking in Manhattan one day, and you know, kippah, and a guy all of a sudden comes over to me and starts and says to me, hey, you're stuck in the past. You're living in the past. So how do you respond? How do you respond to that? So I thought I had a decent answer. I thought I gave him a decent answer. I said to him, those who are disconnected from the past have no future. Okay. Give a regalachas answer. It's true. It's true. You can go on more than that, but there's more to go. All right. Let's go to a heavy one. Let's actually, before we go to heavy one, I have to, before I lose you, let's see. Where we have Zev Jarasha? I have to tell the Zev Jarasha story. Zev here?
Yeah, he's here.
There's Zev. Okay. So, raise your hand, Zev. I don't see you. Oh, there you are. Okay.
Hey, Zev.
Have to tell the story because Zev's a witness to this. You're asking where we see God's involvement in our world. You have to pay attention. If you pay attention, you'll see these things and you'll have these stories. And it's very important to tell stories. The story here, the Gemara is full of stories. Mishnah is full of stories. Why is a law book full of stories? The answer is that's what brings it to life. So you have to have your own stories to tell, and they're there. You just have to pay attention to them. Here's one. Every year I try with Rabbi Sobolevsky and Rabbi Tavis, we walk the Tinek Erev. And sometimes I try to get other people to get involved, Simcha Yat, your uncle, a couple years ago to come with us. I got four or five Rabbanim, we walk the whole Erev. Except for certain parts that are rather obvious. So I'm supposed to be organizing that someone picks us up at a certain point where it's so obvious is after about 3 hours of walking in the baking sun we do in the summer. And part of the area you could easily see it from inside a car. So that part, to make it much more efficient, to save us at least 2-3 hours, to make this doable, to be able to check the whole area. So I arranged for someone to pick us up. So this one year, I think it was 2016, Zev, something like that, right? 2017, yeah, 2017. I was a little negligent, and I didn't arrange for someone. And we're a couple blocks away, and I said to myself, now we're cooked. I'm in big trouble. I'm going to look like an idiot. So all of a sudden, I couldn't believe we got to the right spot. I said, oh no, this is terrible. All of a sudden, and this is in deep into New Milford. Those of you know the area, and a lot of you do. Deep into New Milford, in this little series of stores, a little mall. All of a sudden, who do I see? None other than Zev Jarasha. And you know, in the Jarasha mobile. Those of you know the Jarasha, you know this nice big car. With Eitan Schneier is laughing there, I like that. with nice air conditioning. Eli Harmon, you know what I'm talking about? You have to experience the Jarasha mobile, you know, one time. And there he was. I couldn't believe it. It was right there. I mamish couldn't believe it. There was Zev. Zev, what are you doing here? What are you doing here? This is like Rashi in this week's Parsha. Kodesh Baruch Mazam Pundak Echad, which is it wasn't. It was just me, Hashem. I say this is for a good thing, not like Mizam from Nechad for a bad thing. You know, so Hashem put us there, and Zev was there to save the day. Now, if you don't think that this is Mir Shemaim, okay, you didn't like this one. There's a follow up. So it happened again in 2020 when I was inspecting the Paramus Eruv. And then I realized, and that morning, Mr. Responsible once again didn't arrange for someone to drive. And then, Zev, do you know this part of the story? Then guess who I saw? I was dropping my daughter off to go to, one of my daughters off to go to Camp Hass to be a counselor. And guess what? There was Eli Jarasha. Zev's younger brother was right there in his car with another Jarasha mobile. Also great air conditioning and, you know, the burning hot day. So, really good. Anyway, you have to be on the lookout for these stories. Okay. Before I get to Rabbi Weaver, I have to tell another story. It would not be complete if I did not tell the following story. Where is our good friend, Aviel? Where's Aviel? Is Aviel? Oh, there we are. I have to quote This is one of my favorites. This comment made. How do I know that the Torah is from Hashem? This comes from your good old friend. Can you know who I'm going to quote?
Yeah, Aviad.
That's correct. Okay. Do you remember what he said? You were there when he said it.
Yeah, right? It's quoted in the Sefer.
That's correct. That's right. That Aviad Shelley, one of our Talmidim, he said, and he loves reading fine literature. And he said, you know, this is abnormal. In this book, it was written all these thousands of years ago, and every single pasuk, you find incredible lessons, rich lessons for life today. How could that be? It doesn't make any sense. I remember as a kid, I believe it or not, this was one of my best moments of Amuna came as a kid from my seventh grade English teacher. Her name was Ms. Weintraub. And if anybody knows Ms. Weintraub, let me know. You're going to give her a thank you. And Orthodox woman, young woman, and she taught us Midsummer Night's Dream, one of these Shakespeare's plays. I enjoyed it tremendously. Took us even to the play. I loved it. And I said, it was so rich. But I said to her, I said in class that, yeah, this is great. This is unbelievable. But it doesn't compare. And this is the best secular literature I've read by far. It's unbelievable. Wonderful, but it doesn't even pass, not even 1% of the Chumash. I said it when I was 12 years old. It's not even 1% of the Chumash. And she responded to me. She said, you know why? So the Chumash is from Hashem and Shakespeare is very good, but it's from a human being. Yeah, you know what I'm saying? I think that's what the Gemara speaks about in Brachos. You have to see the Malachim of the Goyim, then you'll be able to see the difference between the Malachim of the Goyim and the Malachim of the Jew. Should be Zochet be Mafkin between the two. You hear what I'm saying? It's a big thing. It's a big thing. All right, let's move on now to some of the mitzvot in the Torah that people have a hard time with, and that's what we're going to start again to this week's parasha. So let's go to a series of those. Let's go to number eight. Rabbi Wiederblank, see if you can give me number eight.
All right. Why does the Torah allow slavery?
Okay. So why does the Torah allow slavery? Actually, just a timeout before we continue. Talk about Erev story. Yoni Lab, I have to thank Yoni Lab. If it wasn't for Yoni Lab, I would not be here today, because one time I was inspecting the West Orange Erev. Ooh, that was a big Erev. I think I was walking in this burning, it was over 90, and it was a 10-hour walk, and I was so hungry, and I called Yoni up. I said, Yoni, can you bring me a chicken sandwich? And he brought me a chicken sandwich. Thank you, Yoni, for that chicken sandwich. If it wasn't for that chicken sandwich, I would not. So if you're enjoying this year, which hopefully some of you are, Yoni, I don't know what I would do without you. Okay, anyway, so here we go. So I have a lot of hot cars. I told Yoni for that one. So now let's talk about slavery, right? How does the Torah allow slavery? And in fact, you know, I don't know what you think of him, but I once saw on YouTube on a video of Ben Shapiro, whether you like him or you not, you know, you love him or you hate him, whatever you feel about him. He was debating Sam Harris. Now, Sam Harris is this aggressive apikoras. I hate to tell you, that there are a lot of aggressive apikorsim out there today, and you have to know how to respond, because I hate to tell you this, but a lot of our guys are watching it, and a lot of our students in your congregants are going to be watching it, and you have to know how to respond. Now, I would recommend, if those of you haven't seen it, Rabbi Sacks debate on the BBC, broadcast on the BBC, against Richard Dawkins. Now, Richard Dawkins is this British, very, very, very aggressive anti-Torah. And in my humble opinion, Rabbi Sacks manhandled him. I think it's worth watching. Even if you don't agree 100% with everything that Rabbi Sacks said in that point. But let's talk a little bit about Avdus. Sam Harris raised this very aggressive apikoras, raised against Ben Shapiro. What about slavery? How can this book be of divine origin? How can this book be of divine origin if it sanctions slavery, which we understand is terrible? We understand now it's terrible. And a civilized society wouldn't hear from it. So I hate to say it, but I saw Ben Shapiro fumper. He did not give a very good answer. And Sam Harris killed him on that one. That was terrible. That's, by the way, the problem with some of these debates. If you don't have a good answer, talk about Chil Hashem, that's a mega Chil Hashem. So let's see if we can give anyone want to venture a half decent answer to the, it's a tough question. Who wants to give a shot at it? Just pay attention to this week's parsha. Yeah, anyone want to give a shot at it? It's a tough question, Zev. Yeah.
Because the Torah gives an option to marry out into the family that's buying you, so you can go back into their class of society.
Oh, yeah. Rabbi Foreman's video on Mishpatim. Very good, Zev. Okay, you're right. Correct.
Could you elaborate on that point? Because that's Eved Ivri. The problem isn't that. Eved Ivri is easy to answer. What about Eved Kanani?
Yeah, that's right, Zev.
I mean, nobody's bothered by Eved Ivri. That there's no shaila at all. The Torah is wonderful.
But a Yiyud is difficult. So Zev gave a good answer for Yiyud. And if you want to look, Alpha Beta, Rabbi Foreman has a good piece on Yiyud. So this week's parsha, it's good. It's very good. Zev is right. But you're right. But Eved Kanani is where the action is. So what's going on over here? How's the Torah sanction Eved Kanani? Whoa, hello. Let's get some answers over here. Everybody asleep? Come. Answers. Hey, Tom, give an answer.
Somebody has their hand up. Raphael Jacobs.
Who's your high school Rebbe? Why didn't he teach
you
the answer to this? Yes, go ahead. Yeah.
Hi, Rev. I would say that, I mean, maybe the Torah was grappling with the existence of the day. And, you know, now that you will, you know, take part in slavery in somewhere or another, here's the most moral way to go about it, you know.
Okay, correct.
Seemingly that, HS Yafeh Tor, and, you know, if you take, you know, a woman from the battlefield, here's the proper way to handle it. But they weren't recommending slavery.
Right. Correct. No, I love that analogy to the HS Yafeh Tor.
How would you explain the Olam Bam Tavodu and the Isser to free a slave?
So hold on 1 second. So I have some answers. Let's see if we could do this. We could spend 10 hours on this one. Let's give it a shot on this one. And I must tell you, I feel that my answer to this needs much more work. But I think the analogy to the Eish Shifas Torah is very important. I think it's a strategy. So the Torah gives you a strategy to battle the Yetzirah. That's what Eish Shifas Torah. You have to speak to people who have been in battle and combat. I feel bad in saying this. I remember once saw a movie I shouldn't have seen. You know, which I forgot what the name of it was. Was described, showed combat, what it was, and I've done shiva from seeing the movie, by the way. So it just shouldn't be a Chil Hashem. But and I remember seeing, and I said, now I get Eish Yafas Tor. In other words, it's so brutal. And I remember describing the movie to my father, who was in combat in the American Army in World War II. I described it to my father, and he actually even saw the movie. He said it doesn't even describe 10% of it. So it was so brutal. And I said, now I can begin to understand the brutality and the intensity of combat and why the Torah has to give the strategy of Eish Yafas Tor. You hear what I'm saying? Sometimes you need to understand that you work with that. What's the Divrei Torah Keneged Yetzer? Here, look at this week's parasha, right? If the Adon kills his Eved Kanani, what happens? Pasuk says, what? Nakomina came. What does Rashi say? Sayah. Mises base is unheard of in the ancient world. What was the slave was you can do whatever you want. It's your property. The owner, the master, is killed for killing the slave. It's unheard of. You cause one of their chavdad rashi varin to lose. They lose one of their limbs and they go free. It's unheard of. But there's something really bigger here.
Can I ask a question?
1 second. There's even something more. Let's talk about Olam Mem Yavodu. And again, I think that this we need a whole more, much bigger discussion. But there's something more than this. Those of you, especially the TABC guys who are Dr. Katz, know what was the cause of the American Civil War? It was what? It was over one law. It was over what? The Fugitive Slave Law. What was the Fugitive Slave Law? That it was expected. It was expected that if you're in the North, the slave ran away, by law, legally you had to return the slave to its owner. Does the Torah have a fugitive slave law? What's the answer to that? What's the answer? The Torah says, just the opposite, in Kiseitse. Lo sasgir ever ladonav shein atzel me'im adonav. Imcha yeshe b'kir b'cha. You hear what I'm saying? There's a lot more to discuss.
With the
Gemara. There's a lot more. But what I'm saying is just a start. It's just a start.
But why, if it's b'di'evad, why would there be aser to be meshachrer? And even that the pasuk you quoted is not under all circumstances. There's only limited circumstances where we say los hasker evad al adonav. And why is there a heter of avodas perach if for an evad kanani?
I'll have to get back there in a couple of hours. I'll tell you that. Yeah, I hear that, but I think the bottom line is the Gemara, the story of Eliezer and Brachos and Amzayin Rebbe, is that we wave lolem tam tavodu so easily. You hear what I'm saying? I suggest Rabbi Wiederblank schedule a whole shiur on slavery, and God willing, invite me, and I'll be more than happy to come. Let's see. I'm running out of time. I know. I'm trying. I feel
Can
bad.
We go
I'm
to question number two. I know.
Yeah, I'm dodging question number two. All right. Let me just, before I get to question number two, which is the hardest one about homosexuality. Okay, mamzerus. Okay, why does Hashem punish an innocent child to be a mamzer? Okay, so you could. I have a whole chapter in Reason to Believe. I go through a Rav Moshe, examples of Rav Moshe, Rav Avadja, how already rooted in Chazal, how far we go to be matur a mamzer, to avoid someone from being a mamzer, number one. Number two is that, and that's a basic, but there were the times of the Mishnah and the Gemara, and there still are today, situations of actual mamzers we cannot find a head there. And in that case, it's basically the Torah is promiscuity is intolerable. There's a consequence of promiscuity, and in society. And I would suggest reading the book, The Other Westmore. I think it's mutter to read it, where you get an insight into a society where there is no, where promiscuity is tolerated, and you see how it destroys a society. The mamzerus is part of the Torah's battle against promiscuity. Irani dachas. How do you answer? Explain. It seems brutal. Irani dachas. Majority of the city is ovdei avodah zara. You destroy everybody, according to some rishonim, even children. The answer is irani dachas. Story about the Lubavitcher Rebbe. Lubavitcher Rebbe, who said, if I hear of a town being an irani dachas, I'd wake up 2 o'clock in the morning. And nailing a mezuzah into an irani dachas. You look at Chabad. I mean, whatever you think of Chabad, it's amazing. Go visit Chabad. I literally view them as the mezuzah achas, the irani dachas. So I would now with all this, I've been dodging it, homosexuality. So yeah, why does the Torah prohibit it? So you know, or how can the Torah prohibit it? People are very upset at this. So the basic answer is like this, is look, if once you believe Hashem gave the Torah, this is Hashem gave the Torah. And once you believe in Torah Shema Peh, once you believe in orthodoxy, once you all these things, you get together, and Hashem's continued involvement in the world. Okay, you have a question. You have a question. And the same thing with slavery, and the same thing with other issues. Why? We can live with questions. Hashem created more questions than there are answers. And in part of the key issue with homosexuality is not so much that the law is immoral. The question is, because it's not immoral. By day, it's from God, and God knows better. That's it. But the question is, why would Hashem create somebody who that's their inclination, or that's their only inclination, it's their only drive? They have no desire to marry a woman, and only a desire is for someone of the same gender. It's more of a question: why does Hashem do that? But it's a similar question: why would Hashem inflict cancer on a child? We don't know the answer. And getting and I think this is the way to respond about the Holocaust: is that we don't know. But you know what? Sometimes it's in our best interest not to know. You know what I'm saying? That's nuts. And we're living in a world where you have to know everything. I want an answer. I want an explanation for everything. But we had Rashi in Parshas Yisro, according to the Gemara Sanhedrin, already at Mara. What were one of the three practice mitzvahs? Different dales, but one of the practice mitzvahs was what? was Parah Aduma, because already right at the beginning, Parah Aduma teaches us why we were taught that there's not everything you have to understand. Not everything we're capable of understanding. Even in science, is light, is it particles or wave? Not everything do we, there's a limit, and sometimes in our best interest not to understand. I see we have a hand up. Let's see, we got 4 minutes left on the clock, and then I'm going to try to conclude. And if you want to stay on, I'll stay on.
Go ahead, Ilan.
Yes.
Yeah, just a quick question. Is that like a lechachila answer to the question of homosexuality, or is that like more of a bidyevit answer just to avoid like the real answers aside from it just being a question?
Okay, in other words, are you saying that's a nice way of saying, Rabbi, aren't you just dodging the question? You know.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I'm not saying that anything that I'm going to suggest is true, but is there what to talk about in terms of whether Judaism values sexuality absent the ability to reproduce or not? And also the question of whether God really created a person to only have inclinations towards the same gender, or whether, you know, that's something that could be addressed, things like that.
Okay, so if I can, let's see if I could take a 30 sec. Let's see if I could do a regalachas for that. You'll forgive me. I think sexuality is not just for procreation, but to strengthen a marriage. But the second is to strengthen a marriage. You don't marry for sexuality, but sexuality is a strength in the relationship between a husband and wife. It's a means to an end, which is fundamentally different than the society that's around us. That sees it as an end to itself. So that also may be part of the answer. But why does Hashem give someone such a powerful urge when incapable of living a happy married life with a member of the opposite gender? That I think is really the core of the question. Did I answer your question, Ilan, half decently?
Yeah, definitely very helpful.
Okay, all right. These are things just starts all these things. Part of the way to avoid a chil Hashem is say this works for me. Look, I personally grew up in a family. We became religious when I was six, and to become someone that's interested, you know, to be interested in learning and committed and trying to convince others to be committed. I must say that this was my journey, and these are things, you know, these are things that to make sense to me, and that's why it convinces me. And to be able to have humility to say to people, look, this is what works for me, and find other things that work for others. But I think actually one last thing, and then I'll stay on for those who want to stay on to take questions. I'll stay on as long as you want. I think the biggest thing is like this. I think, you know, I say in TABC or especially elsewhere, when you get questions, I think the most important thing is to have confidence in the Torah. Once you have, you are completely confident in the Torah, and you're completely confident in the Gemara and Chazal, and you know, into our whole, you know, once you really are confident in it, you know there is a truth, and a lot of time, and you know it's the truth. You know the Torah is the truth. You know Hashem's the truth. You know the Torah is the truth. You will find the right. You will find the right answer, or you'll find answers. First of all, just having that confidence itself, I think, is a Kiddush Hashem. I think that's a very good example, a very important example. And number two, a lot of times when you have confidence, it comes by. Just to give you a mashal, and we'll end with this. You know, when you're playing basketball, or hockey, whatever sport, right, you have to think, you know, I'm going to score that goal. Maybe. You're completely confident. When you have complete confidence, then you're going to succeed. So too, when you are completely confident in the Torah, if you have complete confidence in the Torah, the answers will come to you. Not all the time, but much of the time. Okay. Adkan. The icon for my presentation. You want to stay on? If any questions to discuss, I'm more than happy to do so. Again, thank you for all of you for coming on a Friday. All the TABC guys, it's great. Really, really great to see you. Yoni, again, thank you for that chicken. And it's great, Aviel, as all of you guys, Zach, it's a pleasure. It's a big, big pleasure to see every single one of you.
And it's a big plus for us. We can't tell you how much we appreciate this. And as you see from the questions, Ellie, and I see there's more questions.
And Ellie, to both Ellie's, Ellie Hyman and Ellie Fink, and all of you, again, even if you didn't go to TABC, it's a big, it's a big, big plus to see all of you.
Okay, I think Gabe has a question.
Yes.
Yeah, thank you. I was just wondering, you mentioned a few times like the phrase, like, oh, this is what works for me.
I brought an assistant over here to help me out. Yeah. Yes, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, you mentioned a few times, like this is what works for me. And, you know, I'm just wondering, to what extent does that sort of subjectivize, I don't know if that's a word, make it like, basically like make it a little bit too subjective. Like when a person,
I hear what you're saying.
This is what works for me. It almost sounds like, I've been able to like give myself each of the ass, but there's no actually, you know, objective truth claims here going on. It's just, this is what gives me peace of mind.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying.
Give you peace of mind, I don't know, but.
It's a good tie-in. It's a good tie-in. So my response to that is, the reason why I do it is because, you know, I'm afraid. I run scared with these things. I'm giving an answer. And what if they don't find it convincing? You hear what I'm saying? Then it's a, that's what I want to say. Okay, I'm not the final word. That's what I'm trying to say. I'm not the final word. But I hear what you're saying. It's like, there's a dance. It's kind of like Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, you know, is saying, Oily Omer, Oily Omer. Oily if I don't make that disclaimer, and Oily if I make that disclaimer. You hear what I'm saying? It's a serious downside of what I'm saying. I would just say, and this is something I've said, and when I've made this presentation in previous years, I didn't get a chance to say it, that there's an advantage to not having an ironclad proof, kind of like from last week's parash, or this week's parash, here we go, Kafalem, or last week, Kafalem Harkigigis, right? Kafalem Harkigigis was a problem, Modar Rabo Lo Raisa, the Gemara in Shabbos and Peches. Why is it a modar rabo lo raisa? Because harsina, the way the Meshech Chachma explained, is an ironclad proof of Hashem. There's a downside to ironclad proofs. When in the ironclad proofs, then there's no choice. When there's no ironclad proof, dafka, you have to make a choice. So you hear what I'm saying? That's to a certain extent. By my saying that I don't have ironclad evidence, I think there's a good thing that there's no ironclad evidence, because then you're saying it's a choice. I'm sharing with you why I'm making the choice to have a moon in Hashem, and why is it important to have a choice in the moon of Hashem? Because it's a relationship with Hashem. That's how you have a relationship, a connection with Hashem. That's what I think. I think that's what the Meshech Chachma is understanding. The Gemara in Peches. Ellie Fink, yes.
Yes, can we talk about the, I guess, machlokas mentioned between Rabbi Weirblink and Rabbi Jachter about short answers versus long answers? I mentioned the advantage of having short answers and, like, being able to, I guess, do, like, a spitfire very quickly, otherwise you look bad. I was wondering if it's appropriate at some points to be, like, to say something like, this is a question that requires a longer answer, and I'll be happy to discuss it later, but I don't want to give a short answer. Or do you always have to have like a short, like one-liner available?
Great question. It's a great question. I think that, I think today, at least most people are not patient. They're so used to sound bites. Yeah, why in the business world? You know, if you want to sell your business, you have to give an elevator talk, because people don't want, if you can't say it in 30 seconds, they're not interested. And I just, it's part of the reality today that people think there's something wrong with you if you can't give a 30-second answer. So let's say with slavery. So that's a serious issue. It needs a lot more than here. So I think it's important to be able to have these quick answers, but to say Yosu Masha Karasi Lachem Kasiv Khan, and to be able to say, you know, there's more to it. Rabbi Weiderblank, do you have any other? You have something else you want to add to that?
Yeah, I think that. There's definitely a place for short answers. Like you said, the story of Hillel HaZaken is definitely a very strong indication of that. But I think it depends on the questioner. And a lot That's of true. Times the questioner, A, might be open to a long answer, or right. B, you're not going to succeed in a short answer regardless, because their assumptions are so different than you
right. that
giving a short answer will not help. And just, you know, we don't always, you said, this is the way society is nowadays. We don't have to accept that.
Right.
A lot of times you can't correctly present something in a short answer. And any answer you give that's 30 seconds is going to be false, just because it doesn't acknowledge, you know, to give it a short answer, you oftentimes have to fudge things. Because sure. you have to deny the complexity. You can't yeah. acknowledge
the like issue. With objects.
Yeah. And if you're, and so you're not doing them a service, you give us 30 second answer, and then they finish off with a pircha, because.
Like
without this, like, right. Okay. I don't know. But the point is that that you can't always present everything in 30 seconds. And I don't know. I think there are times that it's better to acknowledge and to tell them, this is a sugya. If you're interested in an answer, or even if you want to say it the way you were saying it, if you're interested in the reason why I believe, I'd like to explain that to you. But it's going to take time. And that this... I don't believe that the fact that I can't give a 30 second answer indicates that it's wrong. And not everything has a 30 second answer. And trying to give a lousy 30 second answer sometimes might do more harm than good.
That's interesting. That's an interesting approach. It's an interesting approach. Yeah. So you have to consider that. It's a good supplement. Yeah. Good supplement to what we discussed. Yes. Ellie.
Can I also ask about, the saying, I don't know, why is, I'm not sure, like, if you say, I don't know, but I believe it anyways, and I guess in some cases it could be harmful, but is it always harmful to say, I don't know, and, like, people will just dismiss Judaism because of it?
If you sometimes. Like, sometimes I think people they see the honesty, so they're acknowledging. But the problem is a lot of times people today are a lot of people sadly are very shallow, and they'll interpret I don't know not the way when we see Rashi saying I don't know and say wow, and see the greatness in Rashi when he says I don't know. Oh, then if even the rabbi doesn't know the answer, it looks really. I've had that.
The objector, didn't you say, I don't know, when we asked about homosexuality? That was exactly your answer. I don't know.
Yeah.
As I think what you were saying is, yeah. You say, I don't know, to every single question, so then that certainly... looks bad. If you present a system that makes sense and you acknowledge that as humans we're limited and we don't know the answer to every question, then that's something that's very different.
I think it is helpful to say a certain, this is the idea I saw for the Rav about the Holocaust, is this to say that it's in our, some things in our best interest not to know. I think that's very important.
You're looking more to know, but you just don't have the answer.
And sometimes say, you know what? Okay, yeah.
You use the phrase, I haven't thought about it enough, instead of I don't know.
Oh, it's a good strategy.
You're essentially not just giving up being open-ended.
This is my son, Binyamin. Yeah, he's my co-author, right? So he's right, that's right. That's a good approach. It's a good strategy. Another good strategy. Yeah. And okay. Any other thoughts? I should have take a moment to advertise Zach Rothenberg's excellent Sefer on Chumash. When are you putting out your next one?
Baruch Hashem, it's in the works.
Oh, good. All right, good. Yeah. Keep them coming.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Keep them coming.
Have a great Shabbos.
Have a very, very good Shabbos.
Yasher Koach. Thank you so, so much once again. And we hope to, I've no doubt that the Talmidim here not only appreciated it, but will continue to reach out for more and utilize your book. And we really, really appreciate it. You taught us a lot, and you also left us a lot to think about.
Okay, very good. Good post-shir discussions. Have a great Shabbos, everybody.
Yasher Koach, thank you so much.
Maybe just stay on just for a second.
Yeah, I'm just going
to try. Ron should be well. Okay.